Good evening, everyone. Jim Solon Sensei very kindly sent me a note this morning reminding me that I was coming to visit, so to speak, tonight, and hoping that I was in good health. And when I replied to his email, I was. And now, not so much. So this just seems to be my fate, and that this tendency to enter a state of migraine just seems to be something I have to live with. And unlike some people, I don't have any, there's no really reliable trigger that I can avoid. Now, some people know exactly what will cause an attack, and then they just don't do that. But I haven't been able to find any such thing. And it is now almost 40 years since these began. So it's unlikely I'm going to discover anything. Anyway, it's not so bad. But it amused me that I had given myself a clean bill of health only until this evening, and then it evaporated. So, but this is this is a little microcosm of our life, and our presence in this world of samsara is a matter of balance and coordination. And when everything is in balance and coordinated, things are fine. And then when something gets a little bit off, we may not feel so well. And this is our human condition. And it is turns out to be a pretty good circumstance in which we may study our actual nature. If it weren't for this tendency to have things be out of balance from time to time, I think our tendency to latch on to an habitual sense of ourselves as a steady, enduring entity would be even more aggravated than it already is. And it's pretty aggravated. I have to confess that it seems that way. It is such a habit, you know. And in that context, the study of Dharma is the perfect antidote. And as such, it's the perfect antidote to the suffering that comes from confusion about our nature. This is, of course, you know, basic Buddhism. I would say the heart of Buddha Dharma is largely a matter of agreement among all sorts of Buddhists. There is disagreement about the details, of course, but the heart is pretty clear and pretty well established. Shakyamuni Buddha, of course, had a particular audience that he was addressing, and his experience of his own situation and the human condition of the many people and beings around him was, of course, conditioned by the circumstances and the time. And in the teachings that we have that people tend to think of as the earliest, as you know, the emphasis was on the function of desire. And then as the teaching developed, Buddhists carried the teaching forward into new eras and new countries and so on and so forth, the implications of the early teachings were brought to the fore. And of course, I would say maybe the pivotal question there is, if our suffering is based on desire, what is desire based on? Or is it just desire all the way down? Well, actually, no. And I understand this is pretty basic, but it doesn't hurt to revisit these teachings from time to time. If from a certain perspective, the fulcrum of the teaching is suffering is based on desire, what is desire based on? And I'm sure you all know the answer to that. And anybody like to answer? Maybe not Soan Sensei, though. You don't get to answer that one. Kenny.
I don't know, is it like cravings or thirst? I don't know, I remember some expressions like Trishna and
Tanta. Trishna means thirst or desire, but what is that based on? Clem-san.
Yes, you know, my understanding is that desire is initiated by contact.
It's true for there to be trishna or thirst or desire, there needs to be contact. But if you back up around the circle, you get to something even more fundamental, you might say. Linda, I'm just randomly picking out people here from the Hollywood squares, so excuse me if I miss somebody.
Wanting something to be different.
Yes. How about backing up even a little further, Larry?
The delusive belief in a separation between self and other.
Yeah. I would say delusion, or sometimes called ignorance. And if you look at the 12-fold chain of dependent origination, it is actually, it's a circle. So it's kind of arbitrary where you pick as a starting point, but very often the starting point that is chosen is ignorance. So if it weren't for ignorance, desire would not be a problem. So subsequent generations of Buddhists over the millennia have focused on ignorance an ignorance of our actual nature. And the remedy for that is, meditative introspection. And that is one approach to breaking that 12-fold chain. Although we're taught that it can be broken at any link. For instance, if you back up from ignorance, you get jara, maranam, or old age, death. And in Tibetan Buddhism, there is recognition that that too is a place where the link can be broken, because it is the teaching there that as we lose the connection with a given birth, a present birth, there is a moment where the so to speak, the mind's eye is completely clear and the actual nature of reality dawns. And one can, at that moment, dissolve one's tie to samsara. What usually happens, though, is that dawning is so intimidating, is so overwhelming, that instead of recognizing it as our own nature, we tend to flee from it, back away and say, oh, no, 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 I don't want any more of that. And then we re-enter the cycle of rebirth. So I was reading one of Jack Kornfield's talks, I guess it was, and he was describing the process that one of his students or someone that he knew who was practicing in the Vipassana context, what his experience had been like. And it sounded very familiar to me. The gentleman eventually signed up for a 10-day retreat, and he had been having some difficulties in his life, and he, as many people do, he had sought the retreat in order to have a kind of respite from his suffering. And at least for a while, the opposite happened. And things got quite a bit worse. And his experience of his suffering was intensified. With the with help from some of the teachers, he was able to recognize that when he was sitting and some thoughts about current situation came up, and in addition, this also is very familiar, one of his neighbors who was sitting developed a cough. All of you who have been on retreats, I'm sure, have had the experience of someone nearby who has some sort of habit or other, like a cough, or they're clearing their throat, or they're fidgeting or something, and it can get quite bothersome. So in addition to his revisiting what was bothering him. Now someone next to him was coughing. And when either his thoughts about his situation would come up, or the person was coughing, and often enough both together, he would get very tense. And the teachers were able to get him to try and notice that dynamic. Okay. So unhappy reflection or noticing something in the environment that was bothersome, and then there would be this tension. And they were able to get him to notice where the tension was, and very gently and with a, you know, an easy touch, relax the tension and see how that changed his experience. And this was tremendously helpful to him, such that by the end of the retreat, he was filled with gratitude to have discovered this approach to human life, basically. And although this was presented, you know, in the context of Vipassana practice, it sounded completely familiar to me. And I was once again brought to the idea, anyway, that the Buddhas actually just have one practice. And that even though you can look at the firmament of Buddha Dharma and see all kinds of practices and traditions and aesthetics and texts and sutras and languages and whatnot, the Buddhas actually just have one practice. And that practice is, you might say, the intimacy of the body-mind in this moment, moment after moment. There isn't anything else. And my experience over quite a few years now of people who become interested in Buddha Dharma and begin to practice in a wide variety of traditions, their experience eventually winds up being more the same than different. And even if the practice is one of prostrations or recitation or this or that style of meditation, the person's experience is much the same. And the encounter with the suchness, if you like, of this body mind starts to look more and more the same across all of the many generations and traditions within Buddha Dharma. And when you get right down to it and link it up again with the basics of Buddha's teaching, how could it actually be different? You know, it almost has to be that way, because the roots are the same. And if you're approaching the study of this body-mind as the fundamental focus, then the so to speak, territory that you will enter and traverse is going to be much the same. If the question is one of confusion about our actual nature, then studying that question in the context of this body-mind right now is going to be much the same for all of us. So I find that quite encouraging myself. And a very easy way to avoid, you know, sectarian preoccupations. That's not to say that there are no differences. But many of them, as I see it, wind up being aesthetic or stylistic. For instance, have you seen a book that I think is actually quite an old book now? It's been around a long time, called Once Born, Twice Born Zen. Has anybody seen that book? Yeah, I think it's probably long out of print. And if I remember, actually, I meant to look this up and didn't get around to it. The author, I think, is Lucian Strike, S-T-R-Y-K. It's quite an excellent book. And it's a very interesting way of looking at approaches to Chan and Zen practice. And how some people are drawn kind of in one direction and others in the other direction. And some people are, what should I say, some people are maybe they come to practice with a pretty established sense that there is some lack, right? That something is missing. And that for practice to be successful or useful, whatever that thing is that is missing must be replaced, right? That missing piece must be gotten a hold of somehow. And for those folks, a practice becomes a matter of arranging for rebirth. Okay. Now that's twice born Zen. And another approach is for people who come to practice and who perhaps the way they hear the teaching is that they already have whatever they need right now. And their practice is not a matter of arriving, you know, moving up to some level of blessing that they don't already have, but instead learning to live and appreciate according to the blessing that is already present. This is once born Zen. And looked at this way, one might say that the Soto approach, or the Caodong approach, to use the Chinese term, is rather rooted in the once born point of view. And the Linji or Rinzai approach, with this great emphasis on provoking a remedial gnosis, You know that word, gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S. This is based on coming from a place of a human situation needing something remedial to happen and trying very hard to bring that about. And that's a kind of twice-born approach. And some people are just drawn to one and some to the other. And some over time will move from one to the other. I was one of probably a great many young people who encountered the dreaded Three Pillars of Sin book, which I read in 1968 or 69, something like that, and was convinced that the remedial experience was absolutely what needed to happen. And I persisted with that point of view for quite a while, until the influence of Suzuki Roshi's teaching and his way somehow persuaded me to let go of that. And I did. And found myself in the warm family embrace of once born Zen. And then when I was asked to take on some teaching responsibilities, and I had some students and one in particular who went the other way. And someone I was very looking forward to ordaining and working with. And next thing I know, this person had departed for the twice born point of view. And I unfortunately did not get to practice with him anymore. So that too is possible. And, I hope that whatever remediation he was seeking happened and that he is happy now. I think that's right. So our way, to use Suzuki Roshi's expression, is pretty definitely and comfortably in the once born camp. And for us, practicing with our essential nature becomes to be seen a greater and greater gift as time goes on. And I think I've used my own teacher's expression for the difference. And he likes to say that the twice born types, they tend to focus at the beginning on what they, so to speak, know. And then if they continue practice over time, they come to love what they know. After years of practice, and the once born types, they tend to begin with what they love. And over time, they come to know what they love. And therefore, the two tend to meet in some place of light and acceptance. The people who carry the path forward in its maturity. So those two approaches are, they're different, but they open up into the same place. They open the same heart, if you like. So I would say, I think, if any of you have been worrying about wait a minute, what, you know, are we actually doing the practice of the Buddhas? I would say, don't worry anymore. We are, all of us, definitely doing the practice of the Buddhas, and everyone who comes to Buddha Dharma winds up doing the practice of the Buddhas, because that's all there is, really. And those other differences are not so important. How is your practice going? Anybody doing okay? Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, Soan Sensei has a hand up. Yes.
Hi. Yeah. We had a small one day sitting on Saturday, and I've been enjoying my consciousness since then. So, and I can't always say that that's the case. So, I'd say right now my practice is just fine. But I also wanted to say that your talk, you gave a kind of, in my mind, a wonderful plug for this event that's going to happen tomorrow. Because at that event, there's going to be this great convocation of, there's going to be a Nichiren priest, and there's going to be a Pure Land priest, and there's going to be a Soto Zen priest. There's going to be Tibetan lamas or, you know, teachers, various people, other priests from various like Thai Buddhist practice and Korean practice. Mm-hmm. This will be an opportunity to see this sort of one heart that you're talking about, I think. And to see, we can test that premise, I think, tomorrow with this event. Mm-hmm. And I think it'll be quite wonderful to do that.
What's the event again? Could you?
Oh, it's an event that's been organized by somebody down in LA. I'm not quite sure. Duncan Williams. Do you know this person? Duncan?
You can Williams. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, he's the one that organized it. And he's called May We Gather. And he has brought together a whole bunch of different teachers and sanghas to support the Asian American Buddhists and people who are experiencing acts of violence or hatred or suspicion. And actually, one of the temples this is going to be broadcast from, Higashi
Honganji, in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that temple was actually vandalized as part of this wave of acts of hatred and violence.
Yeah, that's a very short distance from the Soto Zen Temple, Zenshuji, down there in Japantown. They're very close to each other. So yeah. Yeah. So this is an online occurrence?
It's online. Uh-huh. It's called May We Gather.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And it came to our attention, I don't know, but a whole bunch of different sanghas have endorsed it and signed on as allies of the event. And we did that. And it's 90 minutes long. So there's going to be, like I said, 6 Dharma talks, but they'll obviously be very short. And then there's going to be some ceremonial aspects as well.
Oh, very nice. For some reason, I haven't seen that. I missed that announcement, but that sounds very worthwhile and an excellent showcase for this one heart that I'm talking about. Yeah. I'll look it up online and see what I can see.
I'll send you the link, Mio.
Okay, thanks. Yeah.
Zen Center also has it on their website.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And it's on our website on the front page, actually.
Oh, it is. Okay. All right. Thank you. Okay. Would anyone else like to comment or ask a question? Kenny.
Your talk brings up, what if you think you're Soto and then you become Rinzai or vice versa, or I suppose it I'm always wondering, wait, at some point am I going to go, wait, I'm really a Rinzai person, not a Soto person after all these years?
Well, I doubt you would experience it quite that way. What tends to happen is that persons of a certain type, a certain, maybe a certain karma, among other things, will hear about the practice of koan introspection, and they'll be very drawn to that, and then they may find that's where their energy goes, and that's what they want to do. So it's not so much they'd start thinking, oh, maybe I'm a Rinzai person. It's more like they would feel like, oh, I really have got to do Huato practice, so I will go and look for that. And then sometimes people will go and do some of that practice and then decide, actually, no, I'm not that interested in this. And then sometimes instead they'll say, oh, yeah, this is really great. This is what I want to do. So it's like, well, all right. With our blessing, whatever. And it also works the other way. Persons grow tired of the, this sense that you know, if I don't have such and such an experience from koan introspection, then I'm just, I've missed the boat and my Dharma practice isn't worth anything. And that can happen, actually. I've known some people who, although they have practiced for many years in with koan introspection, somehow always feel like they, you know, they haven't quite come up to whatever the necessary level is. And that has always struck me as very sad. That should not be necessary. Just my opinion.
I have a thought, Mio, that yes. Through the course of any day for me, whenever there's a glitch, whenever something happens or breaks or a mistake, I think that there's the heart of Buddha's teaching. There's this footprint, and I feel very grounded, and I'm kind of happy about it.
Very good. Buddha's footprint. Yeah. Sokan-san, Clem-san.
Yes, Mio. I'd like to thank you for explaining the difference between Soto and Rinzai practice in a way quite unlike anything I had heard before. And the thought that came to mind is that the way you described Rinzai practice was that people perceive that they are lacking something. And the first thing that comes to mind for me when I hear something like that is, well, the implication is that there is something wrong with you. And I spent a good deal of my life up until I found practice under the notion that there was something wrong with me. And I found Soto practice to be very helpful because it's not so much that, you know, I'm missing something, but there's something I missed. Mm-hmm. You know, because if it's not, it just doesn't make any sense to me. If it's not all here, somebody else is going to give you that. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that. Mm-hmm. And I want to thank you and the rest of the teachers I've encountered for making this clear. I do appreciate that. Thank you.
I would just say I wouldn't I guess I wouldn't classify necessarily Rinzai way in that fashion. I would say I would rather use this expression twice born, once born, so that it doesn't become so completely identified with a particular lineage or style. This distinction of once born practice, twice born practice is a little more general than that. That's all I would say. Yeah. Barry-san.
You're still muted, Barry.
Sorry about that. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So I've practiced a little bit in twice born and was it single born and twice born?
Once born, twice born. Uh huh.
Yeah, and you know, I definitely think there's definitely more similarities than differences. I think a lot of, people who do once born practice, you know, they stumble into, you know, how did you phrase it? The event, use the term, I don't remember now.
Yeah. They stumble into what did you say?
The goal of what you were saying, twice born is.
Oh, the rebirth.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's not like that doesn't happen to once born.
Quite.
Practitioners.
That's right.
And all, I think the difference is the once born people just don't talk about it as much.
Right.
You know, for various reasons, you know.
Right.
For one thing, not to preset expectations.
Yes. Of
what it must be like.
As Suzuki Roshi said to Houston Smith, it's not that it's not important, but it's not what needs to be stressed.
Yeah.
And especially to me, that's right on the money.
Yeah. And another thing is, you know, if you, I mean, my experience was a little more, you know, Yasutani style than pure Rinzai, though I have practiced with some Rinzai people as well. And one thing I've noticed is, you know, when you talk to the teachers and, you know, you dive into the practice, you know, it starts off more goal oriented. But as you go on, you know, the duality of meditator and object of meditation, I mean, the whole goal is for that duality to not be there. And at the end of the day, the practice becomes very shikantaza-like anyway.
Uh-huh.
You know, and it's maybe going back to what you said, that, mm-hmm. you know, they kind of converge over time. And,
just so.
You know, I mean, in both of them, you know, you know, to use the phraseology of, you know, Chan is maybe formless samadhi, you know, where there is no object, there's no meditator, there's just, you know, mind. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think is something that happens in both traditions, mm-hmm. but I think it's talked about differently in both traditions. So
yes.
I don't see the huge dichotomy personally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Linda-san.
Forgive me, but I have to tell you, it apparently is out of print, and there's a very good collectible copy available on Amazon for $350.
Ooh, well, line up, everyone.
So if anybody has a copy.
Yeah, maybe it's in a library somewhere.
Yeah, there's a place where you can look for it in libraries. But...
Yeah, wow, 300, amazing. Dave's on.
It seems, yeah, I know earlier in the year in one of our Zoom meetings of some sort, one of the participants had mentioned that she had come from a Rinzai tradition. And she said, the only difference I can see is when the bells are rung.
Oh,
okay. I thought that was kind of. Yeah. And I've read that, different things, you know, the differences, the noted differences, relying on the koans as opposed to relying on the zazen practice more. I recalled reading somewhere, maybe it was in Beginner's Mind or something else, that Suzuki Roshi might have said that you're perfect exactly how you are. You just need a little improvement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. I thought that was cool.
Yep. Yeah. Well, I think it is true that the more time passes, the more these differences do not matter. Yeah. I did. I was eventually persuaded by Suzuki Roshi's remark when he says, "Better to dig one hole and dig it really deep." And my experience has been, yeah, I think that, for me anyway, that makes sense.
We're all doing our best to alleviate your migraine, you know. Oh.
Well, it hasn't gotten any worse, so thank you all. It works.
We're trying to be good medicine.
You have done so. Thank you very much.
And you've been good medicine for us. Thank you.
Well, unless someone has a parting comment or question, maybe that's enough for now. And I hope you will all have a peaceful night and a good rest. And see you next time.